Roughly 800,000 so-called dreamers came to the U.S. illegally as children. Now they face the possibility of deportation. This hour, will Congress come up with a solution? Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Analysis today from Dave Anderson of Iowa State University and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College about the phasing out of DACA, which also affects thousands of people here in Iowa. Also on our program today, Wayne and Dave's analysis of the international uproar over North Korea's latest nuclear weapons test and efforts to avoid the gravest of scenarios. Join our discussion for this Politics Day. First, this hour's news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board this hour, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor and Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne. Okay, we'll get Wayne on board eventually, I'm sure. In Ames, our studio there, Dave Anderson is standing by, I hope, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on, and Wayne will chime in, I'm sure, any moment now. Well, of course, this half hour, largely, a good portion of it, let's say, devoted to DACA, the president's announcement yesterday that his administration was ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DACA, the White House making it clear they want a legislative solution from Congress to protect the roughly 800,000 dreamers, as they are known. These people came to the U.S. illegally as children, now face the possibility of deportation with this latest move by the president, including a number, several thousand dreamers here in Iowa. That's why we want to reach out to our listeners as we talk about this, the first part of our program. Your reaction to Donald Trump's announcing the phasing out of DACA, his call on Congress to address the issue with legislation. Perhaps you or someone you know are affected by this change in policy by the president. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.com. .org. Wayne Moyer now joining us by phone. Hi, Wayne. Sorry for the hiccup there.
Hi, Ben.
Great to have you on board. Talking about DACA, DACA first implemented by President Obama in 2012, an executive decision after Congress failed to pass comprehensive immigration reform or a bill that would have provided protections to immigrants who came here illegally as children through no fault of their own and have no criminal record. Here's a bit of what the former president, then President Obama, had to say in June of 2012 about it.
Effective immediately, the Department of Homeland Security is taking steps to lift the shadow of deportation from these young people. Over the next few months, eligible individuals who do not present a risk to national security or public safety will be able to request temporary relief from deportation proceedings and apply for work authorization. Now, let's be clear, this is not amnesty, this is not immunity, this is not a path to citizenship, it's not a permanent fix. This is a temporary stopgap measure that lets us focus our resources wisely while giving a degree of relief and hope to talented, driven, patriotic young people.
Okay, fast forward to January of this year, a few days after his inauguration, President Trump spoke on ABC News about his plans for DACA.
They shouldn't be very worried. They are here illegally. They shouldn't be very worried. I do have a big heart. We're going to take care of everybody. We're going to have a very strong border. We're going to have a very solid border where you have great people that are here that have done a good job. They should be far less worried.
Okay, bringing us up to yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions formally announcing the end of the Obama-era DACA program, protecting young undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children from deportation.
We are people of compassion, and we are people of law. But there is nothing compassionate about the failure to enforce immigration laws. Enforcing the law saves lives, protects communities and taxpayers, and prevents human suffering. Failure to enforce the laws in the past has put our nation at risk of crime, violence, and terrorism. The compassionate thing to do is end the lawlessness, enforce our laws, and if Congress chooses to make changes to those laws, to do so through the process set forth by our founders in a way that advances the interests of the American people.
Okay, join us, River to River listeners, with your questions. Perhaps this impacts you as it does several thousand Iowans, 800,000 nearly people in the U.S., also people in Iowa, of course. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's turn to you, Dave Anderson. First of all, I want to talk a little bit later about congressional reaction here, but your reaction to the president's move.
I found it to be kind of expected. He campaigned heavily on getting rid of DACA. On the campaign trail, he was vehement about the fact that he thought it was unconstitutional, and at one point he promised to repeal it on his first day in office. The way he did it was kind of surprising, mm-hmm. because he said, well, I'm going to revoke DACA, meeting a campaign promise, but I expect Congress to then seemingly reinstate DACA just in a more appropriate legislative manner. And that's kind of a reversal that I didn't expect from the president.
Donald Trump's tweet, Congress now has 6 months to legalize DACA, something the Obama administration was unable to do. If they can't, I will revisit this issue. End of Donald Trump's tweet there. Wayne, your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, this is passing the buck from the administration to Congress. I think, in a sense, it is justifiable because immigration policy is congressional policy. My main concern here is, can Congress come to grips with this at all, given the amount of things that it has on it, on the agenda, debt ceiling, relief from the hurricane, tax reform, et cetera. Will Congress be able to do this? And you have this whole if they're not, you have this whole period of turmoil before it goes back to Trump, and the uncertainty in people's lives, it seems to me, is really hard to justify.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to some more congressional reaction. On NBC's Today Show, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says that while President Trump made the right decision to rescind DACA, Sessions was wrong to say that Dreamers are taking jobs from U.S. citizens, adding that Dreamers are in school and will add great value to the U.S. Let's listen.
Well, number one, the compassionate thing to do is to give these kids legal status, let them become citizens. They're all non-felons. They have no other country to go to. They came here as young children. They've lived their life in America, and they would add great value to our country. So that's the right thing to do regarding the kids. In terms of the law, 10 attorney generals filed a lawsuit, excuse me, today, suggesting that DACA was unconstitutional. They were going to win in court. DAPA, the legalization of their parents, was struck down by the federal court. So what prompted this was actions by 10 Republican attorney generals to challenge the constitutionality of a DACA. They were going to win. So I think the president made the right decision giving us 6 months.
Okay, let's hear another view from one of our members of Congress from here in Iowa. Speaking with reporters this morning, Iowa Republican Steve King of Iowa's 4th District said that Congress does not have to do anything to protect young immigrants who came to the country illegally as children.
They came here to live in the shadows, and we're not denying them that opportunity to live in the shadows. And when the law is violated, and then people continue to extend.
So you're saying they should stay here and live in the shadows?
I'm saying they should make up their own mind, but they also need to be exposed to the enforcement of the law. If they're encountered by law enforcement officials, the law requires that they be placed in removal proceedings. That's the law. And if you're going to waive the application of the law to groups of people, it is amnesty. And amnesty in America, with regard to immigration, is a reward for immigration lawbreakers, and it is a pardon for immigration lawbreakers coupled with the reward of the objective of their crime.
Okay, Iowa Congressman Steve King this morning. Join our conversation as we talk about the rescinding of DACA within 6 months, by the end of 6 months, 1-866-780-9100. So really here, Dave, you see the question is, well, how much of a challenge? We heard some differing opinions there from congressional leaders. Within the Republican Party, there are differences here, aren't they? They will be revealed?
Yes. Immigration is not a fight that really any congressional Republican wants to wage into right now. The legislative agenda in September is among the more formidable that we've seen in decades. They have an incredibly heavy lift coming up with the budget, the debt ceiling, just so many issues that putting immigration on the table, even with a six-month window, has got to be frightening to many Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear from our Senator Chuck Grassley, chairing the Judiciary Committee. He says he thinks there are opportunities for compromise.
And I'm going to sit back and wait as chairman of the committee to see what sort of thought is going through people's minds of possibilities of DACA legislation, along with some issues dealing with legalized immigration. And see what people want to come up with.
Okay. Dave, go into that. We talk about this so-called standalone legislation to address DACA. Now, how do the camps divide up there? This could possibly reawaken, though, something much broader to a resuscitated comprehensive immigration plan?
It could. A standalone DACA bill that basically codified into law Obama's executive action would get the support of Democrats in Congress, but not all Republicans. A lot of Republicans, Steve King, I think, is one of them, would say that this is not legislation they would ever support. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans probably won't put forward legislation that their entire caucus, or at least the vast majority of their caucus, doesn't support. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult to figure out how they coalesce and get a majority of votes within Congress just on standalone legislation. So one of the things they're talking about is combining this with more comprehensive reform, either tackling the entire immigration system, which is an enormously difficult challenge, but that has not been undertaken in way too long. But part of the problem there is most Republicans want to see border security brought in, including building a wall on the southern border. And that will push away Democratic votes, putting more of an onus on the Republican Party to kind of come to some consensus that does not yet seem to be there.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, though, if we could think, Dave and Wayne, in some period of time, even those against this move yesterday by the president, if this might be a blessing in disguise to get the Congress, to force the Congress to tackle immigration and get some consensus on the reform that is needed. Wayne?
Well, I would hope so, but I worry. Next year is a congressional election year, and election years aren't very good years to get things done like immigration policy. So I would think at the earliest that you could really get anything done would be, in terms of comprehensive reform, would be the year after next. And then the year after that is a presidential election again. So the question is, when can you really get Congress to focus on this?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones. Join our conversation as we talk about the president's move yesterday to rescind DACA. 1-866-780-9100. Peter with us, first of all, from West Des Moines. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment in regards to what Steve King said, implying that these children who've been brought here illegally, in no way are they criminally responsible for being here. Their parents brought them, or other relatives, and they, in a normal court of law, they could not be prosecuted for any such crime because they, as children, had no choice.
Right, right. Peter, thanks for that view from West Des Moines. Let's echo that. I think Democratic Senator Kamala Harris, her state of California, is home to roughly one quarter of the DACA recipient population. Here she is talking with MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell this week.
In order for them to qualify for DACA, they had to answer a lot of questions, and there was basically an investigative process that took place to determine the circumstances of their arrival, to determine are they living a lawful life, have they ever committed a crime, are they productive. And only when they cleared that vet did they receive DACA status. So yes, we want to make sure. We don't want people who are committing crimes in our country to be here if they're undocumented. But we also have to understand that, when we're talking about these kids who are in DACA, they have cleared a vetting process. So for the Attorney General to suggest that they are other than lawful in terms of, in particular, committing crimes is just, it's irresponsible.
Senator Kamala Harris of California. Let's go to Lisa in Davenport, joining our conversation about the president's decision yesterday, ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. We have Lisa with us from Davenport. Hi, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. What is your view on this? What is your question?
Well, I don't really have a question. I just kind of have a comment. I moved here with my girls from Canada. And I had to pay a lot of money to get, you know, U.S. status. So for people to be able to get it for free, mm-hmm. it almost offends me because I had to jump through hoops for my girls and I to become U.S. citizens. And I paid big bucks to get there.
Right. I understand that. I ran into someone at our Pints and Politics event last week, someone, I believe, from Mexico, in fact, who had gone the legal path and was also upset in the same way you are in Davenport. Thank you, Lisa, for your opinion.
Thank you very much.
Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. A poll on DACA. React to this, Dave and Wayne. This past April, Morning Consult, Politico poll, revealing that 3 in 4 Americans who voted for Donald Trump, these are people who voted for Donald Trump, 75% of them support legal status to Dreamers, and in total, registered voters supporting offering legal status to Dreamers by a 78% to 14% margin. Wayne, that's pretty clear.
That certainly is a strong incentive for members of Congress to support retaining it. I suspect there is a majority of members of Congress who would support it, including most of the Iowa delegation. But I think there's big difficulty. Can you come up with a proposal that would satisfy all of the people, Republicans and Democrats, who don't want to retain the program? So the devil may well be in the detail of working out an agreement.
Mm-hmm. The Trump administration distributing some talking points yesterday with a blunt message for DACA recipients, that namely they should prepare and arrange for their departure. This is from the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security urges DACA recipients to use the time remaining on their work authorizations to prepare for and arrange their departure from the United States, including proactively seeking travel documentation or to apply for other immigration benefits for which they may be eligible. Dave, someone hearing that who has never known any other country growing up than the U.S., perhaps than the Iowa soil, that's an amazing thing to hear.
Yes. For a lot of people out there, probably about 800,000 of them, yesterday was a rather terrifying day when they were told that they have to leave their homeland, the only home they've probably ever known. By definition, in order to be a Dreamer, you have to have received either a diploma, some kind of certificate, a GED. You have to be crime-free. You're an upstanding citizen with a good education in this country, and you're being told you have to leave. A lot of these people do not have anywhere to go. It's not that they're returning to their homeland or going to rejoin family abroad. They literally don't have anywhere to go and have to begin a very painful process.
Mm-hmm. An email from, I believe it's Metgro. Is there protection under the Constitution not to be prosecuted for sins by our fathers? Wayne or Dave, anything to say about that? I mean, these children, it's widely recognized. They were brought here as children. It wasn't their decision.
I would say there's no protection per se. It's kind of a loophole in the Constitution that we don't recognize legally that minors are responsible for their actions. So they're not legally responsible. But the fact is they are here and they are not citizens. So they have kind of an uncertain status in the country. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, DACA was never giving citizenship to the Dreamers. All it did was give them a work permit renewable every 2 years that allowed them to stay here and work. But they still had no path towards citizenship, which is why a lot of people who supported the program still didn't think it was great.
Mm-hmm. And it was the spur for President Obama doing this in 2012 was inaction by Congress.
Yes, Congress has had an enormously difficult time talking about immigration, and in part because it cuts across party lines. This is a very complicated issue that is very difficult to campaign on and message easily, because to simplify the message of what we're doing with immigration reform is to lose a lot of the nuance and detail that is essential to understanding immigration reform.
Rachel is with us from Des Moines, listening to our program. Hi, Rachel. Coming up on a break. Welcome to the program. What do you have to chip in?
Well, one of my questions is, you know, like you hear Steve King talking about, you know, obeying the law. Well, it's my understanding that it's illegal to hire an undocumented worker. So, if a person is, you know they're undocumented, you want to obey the laws, then obey all the laws. Why aren't we going after the people who knowingly hire people? Because if there's no job for them to come to, some of them might not be here. You know, that would eliminate a lot of people if they don't have a job to come to. So why aren't we, if we're going to say that we're going to enforce the law, we're a nation of laws, then why aren't we enforcing all of the immigration laws? Why are we just picking and choosing which ones we want to do?
Speaking of picking and choosing, Rachel, I don't know many of us, you could take that even further and say, well, when you go to the store, make sure that your vegetables have not been picked by undocumented workers. I mean, you and I are both aware, and we have been for many years, that a large part of our agriculture is made possible by these undocumented workers, right?
Yeah. Yes, I'm a truck driver. I deal with pretty much everything. Every aspect of my job has undocumented people in there somewhere. This country, for 10 years, I worked as a chef. I know from experience, from my job history, this country would collapse without them. But, you know, we do have laws on the books that say you can't do X, Y, and Z. You know, they have to have visas if you're going to hire them, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're going to say that we're a nation of laws and we have to obey the law, then obey all the laws.
All right. I hear where you're coming from.
Which ones you want to do.
Okay, Rachel, keep on trucking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, comment about that. Wayne, how did we get to this point here? We just accepted more and more undocumented workers because of a failed broken immigration policy?
Well, I think the problem is that the dictates of economics and the ability of the political process to adapt to economic change is essentially not been up to the task. And the economics has drawn people in, but the political process has not been flexible enough that it can deal with the increased economic needs.
Mm-hmm. Let's go quickly to Jim in Spencer. Jim, not much time. We go to break here in a second. Please, welcome, and please make your point.
Okay, well, the premise of this action is to probably save jobs, put Americans back to work, but it's really bad economics when you consider that the best growth in our country has occurred during times of in-migration. People come here, they buy cars, they buy homes, they send their children to college.
We've already invested
a lot of money in these kids. But we should leave them right here where they can be an asset.
Right. I think it speaks to our broken immigration policy, not having control of our borders that have so many people upset. But your point is well taken. Thank you, Jim in Spencer. We'll come back in just a moment. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Dave Anderson with us of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Maybe we'll finish up talking about DACA, the move by the president yesterday to end that after 6 months' time, spurring Congress to act. We'll see when we come back. We also want to talk about the uproar over North Korea's latest nuclear weapons test on Sunday and efforts to avoid the gravest of scenarios. Join our conversation. Stay with us. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So glad to have you on board midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. Glad you are with us in the last half hour talking about the president's decision to phase out DACA, his call on Congress to address the issue with legislation. We'll have many more weeks to talk about that. We're going to move on this hour. We had a lot of input from listeners. Thank you so much for that. We want to get to some very other very important political developments, as has been on our agenda, our docket for many weeks. North Korea, Wayne Moyer, we lean on you especially with your interest and research in international politics to give us your analysis, along with that of Dave Anderson. U.S. and its allies pushing for a global embargo on oil exports to North Korea as the U.N. Security Council now debating a new round of sanctions against North Korea. This comes after that test on Sunday by North Korea. They said it was a hydrogen bomb, much more powerful than an atom bomb. Let's listen to U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, saying that Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, was, in her words, begging for war as she urged the U.N. Security Council to adopt the strongest sanctions possible to stop the North Koreans' nuclear program.
To the members of the Security Council, I must say enough is enough. We have taken an incremental approach, and despite the best of intentions, it has not worked. Members of this council will no doubt urge negotiations and a return to talks. But as I've just outlined, we have engaged in numerous direct and multilateral talks with the North Korean regime, and time after time, they have not worked. The time for half measures in the Security Council is over. The time has come to exhaust all of our diplomatic means before it's too late. We must now adopt the strongest possible measures. Kim Jong-un's action cannot be seen as defensive. He wants to be acknowledged as a nuclear power. But being a nuclear power is not about using those terrible weapons to threaten others. Nuclear powers understand their responsibilities. Kim Jong-un shows no such understanding. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war. War is never something the United States wants. We don't want it now. But our country's patience is not unlimited.
Monday, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. Wayne Moyer, what do you see happening here?
I'm not sure that we can develop sanctions that will really stop North Korea. North Korea is pretty much isolated from most of the world against China, and we're pretty sure that China really wants to preserve the regime to prevent mass exodus from North Korea if it collapses. I worry that more sanctions just escalate the rhetoric more. The North Koreans escalate their rhetoric. We escalate our rhetoric. And it seems to me there are two possible. I do not think a North Korean attack on U.S. interests is likely. They cannot destroy the United States. The United States could destroy them, and they know it. I think the bigger risks are, because both sides have military exercises going on, that there'll be some contact, and that'll escalate the situation, or that if we don't somehow cool the rhetoric, it begins to build instability in East Asia, mm-hmm. in Korea and Japan.
Yeah, Wayne, you say not likely, but when we increasingly, and as the months and years go by, not only, you know, interest in the South Pacific, but Los Angeles, Chicago, New York could be within reach of the North Koreans, right? I mean, that's a tough pill to swallow.
It's a very tough pill to swallow. But remember, we deterred the Soviet Union with massive nuclear capabilities during the Cold War. And if you accept that Kim Jong-un is rational, and I do, and his previous behavior has been rational, at least with regard to his own survival, I think we can make deterrence work in terms of North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Dave, jump in here with your thoughts.
Well, I do not envy the position that President Trump is in. While North Korea is certainly acting in a rational way in terms of the leadership preserving their power, it is very difficult to figure out how the United States and the rest of the world is going to get along with North Korea, because they are clearly developing very capable military arsenals and are acting as if they want to use them. I think Ambassador Haley was correct in saying they're acting as if they're begging for war. And the only thing the United States and the rest of the world can do is prepare for that possibility and hope it doesn't happen. But I think Wayne's right. Our options are very, very limited right now.
Mm-hmm. This comes in a context of the president openly weighing scrapping a U.S. trade deal with South Korea. This is to fulfill his campaign promises. Here's Republican Senator Chuck Grassley saying that the Trump administration's threat to cut off trade with countries doing business with North Korea only ratchets up the tension.
We should have the closest of working relationships with South Korea right now and Japan right now, and then as close a relationships as we can with China at a time when the number one goal has to stop a nuclear holocaust.
Nuclear holocaust, the words from our senator, senior senator Chuck Grassley, who certainly has lived through if not all the Cold War, most of it, and was in office during most of it as well. Wayne Moyer, that's something striking when you hear that our number one goal has to be to avoid a nuclear holocaust from a U.S. senator.
Yes, indeed. I think the risk is not great. But I have to agree with Senator Grassley that preserving very strong ties with South Korea particularly is very important right now. The last thing we want to do in a conflict with North Korea is show a weakening in terms of our commitment to South Korea.
Mm-hmm. Steve in Toledo emails us, China's approach would change if our policy on North Korea would change. We promised South Korea to defend the 38th parallel to our last breath, but our commitment to reunification is over. If it comes to a war, China can determine the destiny of the North. What do you think about that, Wayne, as far as the reasoning? And to give us a little backstory, the 38th parallel is where the truce was. The war is still going, right? It's just a truce, and the dividing line is the 38th parallel.
I think the likelihood that that China would allow North Korea to fall into hands allow any American forces north of the 38th parallel is very, very slight, and it would allow South Korea to absorb North Korea as long as there's a U.S. presence in South Korea would be very, very low.
Mm-hmm. CNN, I see, reporting that the South Korean president and Donald Trump have agreed in principle to revise a bilateral treaty that limits the weight and range of the South's ballistic missiles. The reporting here saying this could give South Korea more independence from the U.S. To react to the threat from North Korea. Wayne, have you been seeing those reports?
Yeah, I have, and I think this is just part of deterrence. Essentially, you're allowing the South Koreans to have larger missiles, which this gives them a greater capacity to retaliate to North Korea if it launches a limited attack against South Korea. So I think it's part of deterrence.
Mm-hmm. What's the best, Wayne, we can hope for at this point? Is it generally acknowledged that North Korea will never give up its nuclear weapons program?
I think that that's correct. I think the best that we can hope for is a cooling of the rhetoric, perhaps a slowing down of North Korea's nuclear program, some kind of commitment not to test any more atomic weapons, conceivably through some kind of negotiations, limit missile testing as well. But I think that would be absolutely the most we could hope for.
Do you see this as a coherent strategy, our State Department, our White House in its approach to North Korea, or as we have seen on several issues during the short Trump administration, that there are sort of diverging lines here, not necessarily on the same page?
Yeah, what has troubled me a bit, there's been talk until what you just mentioned a minute about in terms of agreement between South Korea and the United States. But we've been talking about ditching the economic trade agreement with South Korea. Seems to me that's absolutely inconsistent with the policy of deterring North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. To be continued, the worries over North Korea and the nuclear proliferation there. Let's talk about Congress in general after the summer recess. So much on its plate in addition to that solution for DACA that the president has called for. What do we have? Aid for hurricane victims, raising the debt limit, passing a spending plan, a defense bill. We've got the tax code to rewrite. At least that's the aim. Funding children's health care. The president's call for funding a border wall. Dave Anderson, can you lift a plate with that much on it?
At best of times, maybe. But so far, we're 9 months into the legislative calendar almost, and Congress really hasn't accomplished anything yet. They have unity of party control of Congress, and they have not been able to pass a single substantive bill of any weight. So to suddenly get to September and have these enormous challenges, it's just going to be interesting to see how they can come together.
Mm-hmm. Are the problems that were presented, for instance, in the repeal and replace effort by the Republicans of the of Obamacare, are they present when addressing the litany of things I just went through?
Absolutely. One of the problems I think the Republican Party is facing right now is they got very good at campaigning against Obama and against everything Obama stood for, but they never had to really present proactive solutions. They talked about repeal and replace without ever discussing replace. And when suddenly they found themselves in power, they found out that, as President Trump said, healthcare is really complicated. And unfortunately, that's everything that government does. Everything government does requires a level of seriousness, a level of study, and a level of compromise, usually, to bring everybody to the table together. And the party doesn't seem like it's been very serious about most of these major issues. They don't want to increase the debt ceiling, but they want to reform the tax code to lower taxes. And it's just hard to make all this math work. There's no clear areas of federal spending right now that anybody is willing to cut severely enough to make the math work.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about raising the debt limit, are there disagreements between the factions in the GOP over raising that debt limit?
Yes. The Freedom Caucus in particular has been very loud and vocal for the past 6 years, saying that the debt ceiling should not be raised and that we should just operate on a budget. And if we don't have the money, we shouldn't spend the money. So we should start cutting the budget so we don't need to raise the debt ceiling. And that was, a lot of people do believe that, and that's a great campaign strategy. People can nod their head and say, yeah, that makes good fiscal sense to me. But the reality of the situation is we don't have a choice. The debt ceiling isn't about spending new money. It's about paying the bills we've already accrued. So we have to. There's really not much of a debate about raising the debt ceiling. If we want to alter the budget, we can also do that. The budget also has to be voted on in September. But that's the area to have that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's talk about originally we were going to try to do a clean debt ceiling where we would just vote on that and nothing else. And now there's talk about combining the debt ceiling vote with the Harvey money
mm-hmm.
to help repair Texas. And it just makes the situation more and more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, I see, still wanting to slash top corporate tax rates to 15%. That was in a White House meeting yesterday, reiterating that position the president did. Hit 15%. Today's 35%. How much support does the president have in Congress for such a drastic reduction of corporate taxes? Is this workable?
In theory, he has a lot of support. I think most Republicans right now support cutting the corporate rate. And in fact, a lot of Democrats support cutting the corporate rate. But beyond that, you have to start asking the questions about, well, how do we do it and how do we still fund federal government? Because corporations do pay a lot of taxes in the United States. And if we cut that top tier rate, that could be okay as long as we start eliminating some of the loopholes that have allowed major corporations to avoid paying almost any income tax at all. But there's much less agreement about those loopholes, and there's much less agreement about, well, if we're going to cut the top rate, what do we cut it to? And how do we ensure that we're still bringing in enough money to fund federal government? The repeal of Obamacare was supposed to open up enough leeway with the federal budget to allow cuts to happen without making other tough decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But Obamacare didn't get repealed. The budget still has rather large deficits. And further tax cuts just seem to be a little bit unrealistic unless we're going to agree to have even larger deficits.
A couple of Iowa-specific politics developments to comment on, if you'd like, Wayne and Dave. President Trump nominating the Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, Bill Northey, for an administrative role in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Wayne, have you been following that?
Yeah, I have, and I think that's certainly good for Iowa. There's a strong difference between Iowa's agricultural interests, corn and soybeans, and the interests of southern states, which is cotton and rice, mainly. They have soybeans, too. We have a Secretary of Agriculture who essentially, I think, is representing southern agriculture interests. He's from Georgia.
Sonny Perdue.
So it's good to have a top person from Iowa.
We have another development here. Iowa revoking overtime eligibility for 2,800 state workers, approximately. Critics saying it could cripple government services if employees leave for the private sector and better jobs. Dave, have you been looking at that one?
Yeah, and I think crippling services might be a little bit of an overstatement. The fact is that a lot of Iowa state employees are going to lose a lot of their income from this, and a lot of them are going to probably seek private employment elsewhere. And then Iowa has to decide whether we want to replace these jobs because they do provide essential services or not. I think we will always find people willing to take them. But the real problem is we lose all the expertise of highly educated, highly motivated state employees who've been doing their job quite effectively for some time now. But when you start cutting overtime and cutting pay for people and then asking them to contribute more to their health care, suddenly state employment becomes a lot less attractive. And this state, like many, are currently suffering huge shortages in state employees.
And if I could add just something, who suffers from a result of all of this? Well, most of these people are social workers, nurses, and public defenders. These are people who serve those that are worst off in society.
Iowa's budget, the revenues are rising, but the state's budget still has a shortfall, about $75 million there. Wayne, a comment on that. I mean,
well, if it's over $50 million, they're going to have to call a special session. And then if you have a special session of the legislature, where do you raise the money? Do you have to face taxes just at the beginning of an election year, or do you take it away from some other program? And then one other issue is how broad an agenda will the special session of the legislature have to have? And then what kinds of issues then get opened up as a result of a special session that wouldn't otherwise get opened up?
Just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to see if you two were ready to run out to the bookstore to get Hillary Clinton's new book out. What happened? Simon & Schuster putting that out. Some 500 pages almost. A look at the campaign through the eyes of the contest's losers. Dave Anderson, you don't already have your copy. I think it was CNN's one media outlet found a copy somewhere, actually.
Yeah, CNN got an advanced copy and already read it and are reporting on it. And honestly, that decreases my motivation to read the book because I think it will be reported on endlessly over the next few weeks. So I think I will save my time from having to open the cover.
Okay, well, the short version of your autopsy on her failed campaign?
Oh, my short version. Well, I will tell you that she seems to say in the book that she puts the blame largely on Russia, the Comey letter, and on Obama for not really supporting her very strongly, especially by calling out Russia and the fact that Comey didn't have anything to report on.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, have you been watching the reporting on Hillary Clinton's book coming out?
I haven't so much on the book, but in terms of the election, I think there are a number of things there. Certainly the Russian involvement is part of it. Comey's part of it. I don't think Hillary ever got her message together to sort of really inspire people. Blaming it on, I think it's counterproductive to blame it on Obama.
But also blame there, I'm hearing, on Bernie Sanders, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but again, I think always blaming your problems on somebody else is to me, always problematic.
Yeah, Dave, you had something to say about Bernie Sanders being blamed?
Yeah, Clinton definitely puts the blame on him for putting together a very strong, passionate group of supporters who never really engaged with her. They blamed her for Bernie not being the nominee, which I guess is fair. but they never took seriously the choice of alternatives. It was either going to be President Clinton or President Trump, and a lot of Bernie supporters threw their hands up and said, well, we just can't support Clinton.
And we know from polls now that a good number of them went actually to support Donald Trump in the general election in some key states.
In some key states. It doesn't look like the Bernie supporters made the difference, but okay. It certainly rubbed salt in Hillary's wounds.
A note for the end of today's politics program. If you're headed for the polls next week for school board elections, be sure to take note of some new requirements that are part of the voter ID bill that the legislature approved this year. If you're a registered voter and you've moved within the county and haven't let that county auditor know your new address, you'll have to show some proof of your new residence, such as a recent utility bill. Just a note there. Now, note also, this new mandate to show identification at the polls doesn't go into effect until next year. Look into that if you've moved within your county. I want to thank Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College for being with us on this Politics Wednesday edition. Dave and Wayne, always wonderful to hear your insights.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Robbie Broad helped out today as well. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.